Right. Hello, West Side. Well, I love envisioning the earliest Christians who were persecuted, often harshly mistreated by both Jewish and non-Jewish opposition throughout that first century. And when they were, they still seemed completely like impervious to threat. Just rock solid, not just standing firm in the face of hostility, but even going further than that, they were actually friendly and kind toward their enemies. So you've got Paul, who's an early church leader in that first century, encouraging Christians in Corinth by saying things like this. He says, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed." And then he says to Christians in Rome, he says, "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but do what is noble in the sight of everybody. Never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God. You let vengeance be God's business, not yours. Instead, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If your enemies are thirsty, you give them something to drink. Do not be overcome by evil, but rather you overcome evil with good." Can you imagine a whole population of people living in that way, relating to others in that way? Can you imagine a church community in this world that we're living in right now, a church that is known for being that kind of strong? I do love that vision, that image. Well, maybe you've noticed that it is pretty hard to have a satisfying relationship with someone who is easily offended. Have you noticed this? Hard to have a satisfying relationship with somebody who's easily hurt by your words. Now, hold on. If you were easily offended by what I've already said there, just hold on. Don't be leaving the room just yet. I'm not actually talking about you. I'm actually talking to you about other people. All right, other people in your life who are easily offended. And what I'm saying to you is I bet you have noticed that it's hard to have a satisfying relationship with someone who is easily offended, a person who's easily hurt by your words. It's not impossible, I'm not saying that. It's just difficult, it's hard to have a satisfying relationship with that person. And I think you probably know why this is. When you suspect that a person, a friend, is easily hurt by your words or your thoughts or opinions, assuming you don't love hurting their feelings, you might find yourself, holding back a little bit. You might feel like you're kind of walking on eggshells sometimes. You might often avoid saying like the full 100% of what you're actually thinking. So you give them like 60% of what you're actually thinking. But there's a last 40% that you never end up sharing with them. That's 40% of you that they never end up coming to know. And so by my calculations, that relationship works out to be about 60% satisfying, about 40% frustrating, about 40% blocked from really knowing each other and being known by each other. Now, there's a lot of reasons why a person might be easily offended, easily hurt by words and opinions from other people. Maybe a person could have been exposed as a child to a lot of hurtful words in their past. They wouldn't have had to have grown up in a verbally abusive environment per se, but just one, where there was a lot of criticism or maybe a lot of anger in the home. Or, of course, on the other end of the spectrum, a person could have been underexposed to negative feedback of any kind when they were a child. And then they, of course, grew up on a strict diet of praise and only praise. That would mean that you would feel like negative feedback of any kind is a little dangerous if you grew up in that kind of environment. And of course, a third possibility is that a person could just be raised in a culture that gives certain advantages to the offended. Kind of rewards that experience of being offended. So my daughter, whenever I playfully or legitimately forget how old she is, which is fairly often, she has learned to kind of feign offense to get a chuckle. And, I'll be like, "Harper, how old are you again?" And she'll be like, "Dad, how rude." I'm so offended that you would, you know, forget your daughter's age. How could you? And now, what's going on there? Is she genuinely offended? I kind of doubt it. She could be, but I kind of doubt it because she knows. I can't remember anybody's age in my house. I can't remember my age half the year. So I don't think she's actually connecting. I don't think she's offended there. Well, where'd she get the punchline from? Like, where's she picking this up? Did she pick it up from somebody else in the house? I don't think so. From my observation, I don't think she's getting it from anybody else in the house. I think she's picked it up just from being a part of a culture that doesn't just pretend to be offended. Now, our culture knows that being offended comes with some positional perks. Not relational perks, but positional. So it's not uncommon for you to find people leveraging their experience of being offended into a kind of advantage over someone, a kind of position of authority over the offender. See, when I can claim that you've hurt me, that gives me a kind of power over you. If I am offended by what you've said, it's very believable to everyone who's paying attention that you are the bad guy and I can look down on you from a moral high ground. I have the right to be angry at you, I might say. I can be outraged at you, which, you know, feels very powerful. I might even have the culture's permission to retaliate against you. Culture will be on my side. It'll take my side. That's because this culture, for the most part, aims to protect victims and punish villains, which, you know, given the alternative, this is the kind of culture I prefer to live in. But what that means is being more and more easily offended as time goes on might just be a predictable byproduct of growing up in this culture. But ultimately, being easily offended isn't going to do our relationships any favors. It's hard on those. When our offendability goes up, the quality of our relationships goes down. When everyone in a culture is easily offended, don't be surprised. You can expect relationships to suffer. They're going to suffer. So maybe you're already tracking with me, and maybe actually you're way out ahead of me, further than you should be actually, and you're already thinking like, yes, I want to be totally unoffendable. If being offendable is a bad thing for relationships, then all right, I want to be totally unoffendable. That must be a good thing. So our whole culture should be totally unoffendable. Well, hold on here. I wouldn't go there too fast because just shifting to the other extreme could actually come with some problems too. There's actually a way of being so unoffendable that it can be detrimental to our relationships. It's actually a fairly common version of this. It's a more stoic way of becoming unoffendable by choosing not to care about anything, flipping the numb switch. Maybe you've discovered that apathy switch in the back of your brain. You can just kind of flip that switch on to turn on the apathy and to shut off the feelings so you could stop caring. You know, flipping that switch enables you to suppress any unpleasant emotions, you know, for example, like the feeling of being offended. You can suppress that so you don't have to feel those unpleasant emotions. You can just stop caring what people think about you. So you flip that switch and you can say, I don't care what you say about me. I don't care what you think about me. You are nothing to me. Yeah, well, I mean, if you live like that, if you turn on that kind of apathy switch, that kind of heartless apathy shield every morning, like, yeah, you're probably going to be pretty effectively shielded from people's criticisms. You will indeed be unhurtable, unoffendable. But if it comes at the expense of caring, well, then in the end, your relationships with people are going to suffer. They're going to suffer that way too. Now, what we all want, is to be both caring about people and unaffected by people's criticisms. I mean, that's the goal, right? Like, that would be the right kind of unoffendable. Well, I happen to know a guy who might be exactly that right kind of unoffendable. He's very hard to offend. At the beginning of his ministry, word was getting out about Jesus. Word was getting out about this possibility that Jesus might just be the promised Messiah, the heavenly king sent to deliver God's people. So when Jesus starts inviting people to follow him, to become his disciples, his students, people were pretty excited to say, yes, count me in, I'd love to follow you. Philip being one of those guys. And as soon as Philip says yes to following Jesus, he rushes home to tell his buddy Nathanael. And he's like, bro, you have got to come check this out. We have found the Messiah, his name is Jesus, and he's from Nazareth. Nazareth. Now, Nazareth was a small backwater town in the region of Galilee. Nazareth was the kind of place that maybe had a few stop signs, but they didn't have any stoplights. Nothing going on in Nazareth, so there's just not a lot of income there. Nothing close, nowhere close to like an educational or commercial hub where, you know, important things are happening. Everybody in the region knew that Nazareth was a kind of nowhere with a bunch of nobodies living there, right? And so when Nathanael hears that this supposed Messiah is from Nazareth, his expression out loud, he says out loud that common geographical bias of the day, one that maybe everyone was thinking, but no one was saying out loud until Nathanael says, Nazareth? Can anything good, has anyone at ever point in history ever, anything good ever come from Nazareth? Philip's like, well, maybe, why don't you come check it out for yourself. So Philip takes Nathanael to go see Jesus. And as Jesus sees Nathanael approaching, he says, ah, here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit. And Nathanael's like, you know me? How do you know about me? You know, how did you know that I'm a tell it like it is kind of guy? Like I'm a call him as I see him, truth telling kind of guy. How is it that you seem to know how I am? And Jesus replied, Nathanael, I could see you under the fig tree before Philip found you. And then Nathanael exclaimed, Rabbi, well, you are the Son of God, the King of Israel. Such a curious, intimate little exchange here between Nathanael and Jesus. We don't really know any details about that fig tree. Like, what's up with the fig tree thing? Like, what's going on? Like, why is this fig tree spot so significant to Nathanael? I don't know. There's a lot we don't know. We can just speculate. But it appears that by mentioning it, Jesus is signaling to Nathanael that he knows the secret parts of Nathanael's life that only God would know about. If you were in that situation, would that be comfortable or uncomfortable for you? Like if you were to find yourself in a conversation with God, you know, you're standing there before him and you are fully realizing that he knows everything about your whole life, every foolish thing you've ever done, said, thought, felt, believed. Maybe Nathanael in that moment is thinking, oh no, this guy knows everything about me, including the last offensive thing I just said about him a minute ago to Philip. You know, that was a really ugly, prejudicial, bigoted thing to say. I mean, I slurred this one who might actually be my king. Oh my goodness. And his family? And his, like, oh man. I mean, well, fortunately for you, for me, and for Nathanael, this Jesus guy is a pretty hard guy to offend. So instead of focusing on Nathanael's insult, or even focusing on his ignorance, instead of paying attention to the history of offensive things that a brash guy like Nathanael has probably said in his life, Jesus instead opts to focus on and even affirm a positive part of Nathanael's character. He returns insult with undeserved kindness because that is what grace does. Instead of focusing on the offense, Jesus saw through the offense to the whole person behind it. He saw right through the prejudice that Nathanael expressed and probably even believed in his heart and mind. He saw right through the ugliness of whatever was said all the way to the person, the whole person. Underneath it all. That's hard for us to do, but I bet you've had moments where you've done this successfully, moments that you've chosen to remember, that line that hurt people, right? You've probably heard that. What kind of person might say something awful and hurtful to you? Well, it's someone who's probably experienced some kind of hurt themselves. Maybe you've reminded yourself of that line. Maybe initially as a way of defending yourself against a kind of attack, but it eventually moves you. Realizing it, remembering that moves you into a different space, one of pity and compassion for the person who's bringing an attack. And you eventually are moved to mercy. Apparently, getting offended is optional. There are other options. Getting offended is not some kind of cause and effect certainty. It's not something that just automatically happens to you when something offensive is said out loud. No. It's a choice that you make to focus on one thing rather than another. So when you opt to focus on how shocking the offense was, how hurt you are, how surprised you are, how malicious the motives in the offender must be, right? When you're focusing on those things, you are making a choice to be offended. And when you instead opt to see the person who offended you as a whole person, when you choose to consider all of the complexities and layers of experience that have made that person the way they are, and when you focus your attention for just a second on the fact that they are a broken human being, a marred and incomplete reflection of God, in desperate need of rescue, just like you, when you can just focus on that for a second, that's often enough to shift your weight from feeling hurt to feeling love. Now, doing that, remembering that, focusing on that, doesn't undo the wrong that might have been done to you. This doesn't make what they said, it's okay, it's no big deal. No. It doesn't completely undo the hurt caused. You might still be hurt, but there will be something other than the hurt at work in you, overriding the hurt, overcoming whatever evil was done to you. Another thing that I think made Jesus hard to offend is that Jesus believed and he operated on, he lived out the truth, lived on the basis of, in alignment with the truth, not half-truths. What do I mean by a half-truth? What's a half-truth? Well, a half-truth is a line that sounds true, but upon further examination, we actually see that it's not completely true. So a half-truth, you might say, is a spoken truth plus an unspoken lie, something false. So the spoken part, it might be true, but there's an unspoken assumption. It's not spoken, it's just assumed, and it's attached to the thing that's spoken. So that in the end, the whole thing's not true. So for example, you might try to offend me by saying, Chip, I don't like you. That's the spoken part, right? But there's something attached to that that you and I both might assume to be true. And that's the part in brackets, right? Like you're also kind of assuming that we both believe that I need you to like me, right? Well, that first part might be true. That's the part that you say. But that second part that's assumed, that's not true. I don't actually need you to like me. If you don't like me, I'm ultimately going to be okay. Now, I would prefer that you like me. I really would. That'd be my preference, but is that my need? No. And that's what makes it not true. Notice that if I believe the unspoken lie, if I believe that thing that I need you to like me, then I'm going to be hurt when you say you don't like me, right? I'll be hurt by the spoken part. That's when I'll be offended. So the unspoken lie is what gives the spoken part, the offense, its bite, its sting. And if you don't believe the lie, then the offense loses its sting, it loses its power. There's another half-truth example, you might say, you know, to me, something I could be offended by. Chip, your message today was just garbage. It was trash. I hated it, right? Now, that's the spoken part. The unspoken assumption, the unspoken lie would be, and Chip, every message you deliver needs to be excellent according to everybody, right? Everybody needs to think it's awesome, right? Well, that second part's not true, right? Now, what you said to me, that might be true. This message might be garbage. But that's probably not going to hurt me unless I believe the unspoken lie. If I believe that every message I deliver has to be awesome according to everyone, well, then hearing what you say about this message being garbage, that's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. See, totally believing half-truths, believing half-truths wholesale, just swallowing the whole thing, that's what gets us in trouble. That's what gets us hurt. And if you tend to fully believe things about yourself that are only half true, heads up, you're probably going to get hurt easily and often. Jesus didn't do that. He didn't operate on half-truths. He believed and operated on the truth. For example, in this situation, if we play around a little bit with this interaction between Nathanael and Jesus, if we were to kind of take what Nathanael said to Philip and turn the offense factor like up a few notches, like let's say that Nathanael said to Jesus' face, "Jesus, I heard you're from Nazareth, which is nothing but a garbage town. Everyone I've ever met from Nazareth is good for nothing. So I assume you're pretty worthless too." I think we could all agree that that'd be a pretty offensive thing to say to Jesus. But in order for that to actually sting Jesus, in order for that to hurt Jesus' feelings, Jesus is going to have to be a sucker for the unspoken thing that's attached, the unspoken lie that's attached to it, right? So it'd be like this. You know, he says, Nathanael would say, people from Nazareth are worthless. The thing you'd have to assume, the unspoken lie part, would be that a guy's hometown determines his worth, his value, right? Well, come on, no one, who believes that? That's ridiculous. When you say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous. And Jesus, you're not going to pull that one on Jesus. Jesus knows that that's just patently false. Jesus knows that the dignity of every human being comes from being created in the image of God. Goodness, he helped write that truth into the fabric of the universe. He knows that a person's worth has absolutely nothing to do with where a person grew up, nothing to do with their skin color or their ethnic group or their cultural subgroup that they belong to. It has nothing to do with whether they're rich or they're poor or they're highly educated or completely illiterate. Jesus knows that every human being gets his or her value, his or her worth, simply from being created in the image of God. And when your feet are firmly planted in that truth, the most insulting, the most offensive comment imaginable launched at you is only going to be half true at best. And in the end, the offense is going to be completely toothless. Doesn't have a leg to stand on, like a paper bullet hitting you. It doesn't weigh enough. Doesn't weigh nearly enough to break the skin and draw blood. See, if we always believed the whole truth about ourselves, about our inherent value and worth, if we always believed it, we would be extremely hard to offend. Sometimes our being hurt is actually less caused by what someone else has said. It's actually more caused by a voice inside our heads. You know what voice I'm talking about? It's that voice, I bet you're familiar with it. It's a voice that often uses the word enough. Right? I'm not pretty enough, not smart enough, successful enough, disciplined enough. You know what voice I'm talking about? Like you might already be so familiar with that voice that you're in the habit of just shutting that voice down. When you hear that voice saying you're not whatever enough, you're just like, voice, shut up. You just, I'm done listening to you. That might be your tactic for dealing with that voice. And you know, that's not a bad tactic. You can still do that. This week, I want you to experiment with another tactic. The next time you hear that voice telling you you're not enough, I want you to dare that voice to just keep talking. I want you to challenge that voice to finish the sentence. Because when it stops at the word enough, it's actually only giving you that, the first half of the sentence. So you tell that voice to finish the sentence. You say to that voice, I'm not pretty enough to what? I'm listening. Keep going, I'm listening. I'm not smart enough to what? To be valuable? Is that what you're trying to say? I'm not successful enough to be loved? Really? I'm not disciplined enough to be made in the image of God and intrinsically, mind-blowingly valuable because of his love? Is that what you're trying to say? And once that voice in your head has completed the full sentence, I want you to take it out and I want you to show it to Jesus and see what he thinks of it. I bet he won't think much of it. Heads up, we live in a world that would have you believe that you get your value from all kinds of things, how productive you are, how much you bring in, how popular and liked and physically attractive you are, how competent you are. It's false. Your value ultimately comes from a God who loves you. And when you operate your life according to that truth, you become extremely hard to offend. And what's more, you actually set yourself up for some really great, satisfying relationships. The religious leaders accused Jesus of saying things that he just didn't say. They were saying he had been stirring up trouble with his teachings about God's kingdom. They accused him of corrupting the very people that he was actually coming to rescue. He's standing there before Pilate, and the room is just filled with angry yelling, contempt, offense, just catastrophic misunderstanding filled the air all around Jesus. And as an insult, they dressed him up in a royal robe and a crown made of thorns just to mock him, and his claim to be God's all-powerful king. And in all of this, Jesus remained just rock solid, extraordinarily quiet, saying nothing to prove his case, saying nothing to defend himself, like a sheep that's silent while it's getting sheared in those dark moments before its death. Jesus didn't say a word. You want an image of somebody who is unoffendable in all the right ways? I want you to picture a thorn-crowned Jesus wearing a purple robe, presented in abject mockery, standing before a jeering crowd that is shouting for his execution, and he is looking at that crowd and silently loving them, preparing to lay his life down for each and every one of them. That's the image. Wait a second, you actually know. That's only the beginning, isn't it? That's not even the climactic image, is it? Because from there, they led him out to be crucified. Crucifixion being the most excruciating, most humiliating execution that was available at the time. You were beaten and whipped, paraded through a sneering crowd with a crossbeam on your back, stripped completely naked, and hung on a cross with spikes through your wrists and ankles, raised up to die a most undignified death before a crowd who believed you deserved it. Was he hurt? Of course he was hurt. He was surely as hurt as he was human. But there was something other than hurt that was driving him. Something was overriding the hurt, overcoming the offense. And so he prays. He's hanging on the cross and he prays. He prays a prayer not for justice and not for revenge on his enemies. He doesn't pray a prayer for anything related to his own hurt. Instead, as he hangs on the cross, Jesus prays for those who were unjustly executing him. And he says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. That's a guy That's a guy who's hard to offend. That's a guy who is so secure in the truth about himself, so undeterred by things that just aren't true, choosing to look through the ugliest offense to the whole people behind it. That's a guy who's hard to offend in all the right ways. As the world's most innocent human being, the stage was set for him to be the most offended human being who's ever lived. But that's not what Jesus chooses. Jesus actually responds with a most radically unoffendable grace. When you are grounded in the truth about yourself, you're able to see the whole truth about those launching insults and offenses at you. Not only will you be unshakable against insult and offense, but you will be freed up to live a life of rich relationships, the kind that God himself enjoys, even enjoys with people who are difficult. Jesus says in Luke 6, he says, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on the cheek, you offer the other cheek also. If someone demands your coat, offer your shirt. Give to anyone who asks, and when things are taken away from you, don't try to get them back. Do to others as you would like them to do to you. Now, you love your enemies. You do good to them. Lend to them without expecting to get anything back. And when you live and give like that, then your reward will be great. Then you will be children of the Most High God. You will be reflections, spitting images of your Heavenly Father, because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. And when you are merciful to others, as your Heavenly Father has been merciful to you, you can bet you're going to be hard to offend in all the right ways.